You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Brooke Kamen Rappaport. She is the senior curator at the Madison Square Park Conservancy, controlling the public sculpture in the park. She's been an independent curator for quite a while. She received her degree, MA, from Rutgers University, before that Amherst, and also was a Helena Rubinstein Fellow in the Whitney Museum Independent Study Program. Brooke, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Brainerd. I'm really happy to be able to chat with you.
So I'd love to know more about what's happening, and congratulations on being the senior curator. That's a very exciting position. I know that's that just happened, so congratulations. I've always loved that park.
Thank you.
It's really one of my favorite places in the city to see art, in fact. It's just a lovely park that's grown so much, and nice to see such kind of interactive and wonderful things there.
So, we call Madison Square Park a museum without walls because the original late 1800s, early 1900s plan for the park enabled not only a winding pathway that was opposed to the strict grids, the strict geometry of the Manhattan street plan, but it also enabled Madison Square Park to have really separate rooms without walls that are grassy lawns, and we use those as different areas to display contemporary art. We have three different contemporary art commissioned projects each year, one opening in May, one opening in September, and typically there's a winter project. And the artists work with us at the park to determine where they want to install their work, what site on the lawns really suits their project the best.
I didn't know when that park was designed. Was that an Olmsted design, the original design of that park?
It wasn't an Olmsted design. We have other boldface names from that period who have objects in the park. There's a Augustus St. Gaudens and Stanford White collaboration in the Admiral Farragut Monument. We have monuments to Seward, the Secretary of State under Lincoln, and Conkling, Roscoe Conkling, who was important in the Civil War era. So, no, it wasn't Olmsted, but there are other important figures who have made work in the park across time. We're also graced by the Flatiron Building to the south, and the New York Life Building also is on our perimeter.
And the work, I mean, you mentioned some permanent pieces that are in the park, but the work that you curate in the park and has been curated by the Conservancy for at least the last several years has all been temporary. Is that correct?
That's right. So we commission artists, contemporary artists, to make oftentimes monumental sculptural projects in Madison Square Park. And for some artists who are very advanced and senior in their careers, this can be a moment professionally where their career is revivified or where they have a new opportunity to create a large outdoor work. For a younger artist, having a work in Madison Square Park can really be career defining, and it can change how their projects are made and how they're viewed, by the public and by members of the art world going forward.
Absolutely. It seems that most of the artists that I've noticed are mature artists, are mid or late career artists. Have there also been recent young artists?
Last May a project opened by Orly Ganger, who is a New York-based artist in her 30s. It was 1.4 million feet of crocheted lobster rope, and the rope was hand crocheted by the artist, and then she layered that rope into really walls that circulated around three of our lawns. They were also monochromatic. She painted them, painted the rope. There was a red section, a blue section, and a yellow section. So Orly has since working with Madison Square Park. That project that was here traveled, and it's on view now at the De Cordova in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and she's just opened a piece, a rope work on the Chicago waterfront. So people are learning more about her and her projects and really seeing how significant a contemporary artist she is. And we're very proud, you know, to have had that that work here in the park.
Yeah, that's very exciting. And that's, and I know her work, and I don't know her career that well. I certainly know the crocheted work and her history of that. And that must be one of the largest works she's ever produced in her career. Is that correct?
It took 2.5 years to make. She and a team of assistants worked kind of 24/7 for 2.5 years in her studio, and literally hand crocheting lobster rope that had been found by my colleagues here in New England, and it was repurposed lobster rope that was trucked down to her Brooklyn studio. So yes, it was an extraordinary effort and a hugely physical effort that she realized this piece for Madison Square Park.
Wow, yeah, it's interesting because it sounds, you know, sculpture often can take on this heroic scale, and in a sense that is this. You know, the process sounds heroic as well as the scale of it itself, because
it's true. That's a really good way to put it. It's not only what the public sees when they come upon these monumental pieces in an outdoor setting, but it's really the behind-the-scenes story that's equally monumental because of the time and the effort and the physical needs that take to create all of the pieces that we show here. So, yes, the backstory can be as interesting as what you see right up in front.
Well, it's also a large part of the production. I imagine, I don't know exactly how commissions work there, but then you're helping to produce and pay for those years of building. Is that how it works?
We have really strong partnerships with the artists, and I think that opportunity for them to be able to realize the work in the park is one that is so important, you know, professionally to people, that they are they're willing to kind of stop time oftentimes in the studio and just assume this one very significant project.
And then does the Conservancy finance that studio work too? I mean, working with assistants for those years sounds like it would be very expensive. Or
right, the Conservancy, yep, sure. We have a budget and we fundraise for different projects. Yes, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about what's happening in there now. That's Giuseppe Pannone, if I'm saying the name right.
So right now we have Giuseppe Pannone, who is an Italian artist. He is an internationally recognized artist. He's in his late 60s. He lives in Italy, and he was best known as being the youngest member of a group in Italy called the Arte Povera group. Those were artists who used very basic materials to create their work. And since that time of the 60s and 1970s, Pannone has regularly included the image of a tree in his work, either through sculpture or flat work that he's done. So for Madison Square Park, which he visited first in 2008, so you can see that there's a gestation period in the artist's mind and in planning for an exhibition, Pannone wanted to bring trees to the park to really complement and question the natural landscape of our park. So he created three 30-foot tall bronze trees, and we shipped them here from Italy, and they are now installed in Madison Square Park through February 9th. And I hope that you and your listeners will come to see the works on view. What's fascinating about them is not only that they are absolutely stunning, but very subtle and contemplative objects on our oval lawn, but also that each of these trees holds or harbors or nestles enormous boulders that came from the river, the Orco River, just outside of Turin, where Pannone lives. So as part of the sculpture, each tree is holding these enormous boulders that weigh hundreds of pounds.
Wow. I mean, that sounds like an extraordinarily expensive and literally weighty work to ship across the Atlantic, no?
Right. So one of the trees is 7,000 pounds, one is 10,000 pounds, and one is 12,000. But, you know, when you're a cargo shipper, this is all in a day's work. So so that was kind of standard fare for them. But we did have a crew installing the work with the artist here. And it was a fascinating process to watch the actual installation and also to see how the public was truly fascinated to watch and to anticipate, you know, these objects being installed and being put together with the artist really front and center. So he was an absolute pleasure to work with. He is exacting and skilled as an artist, and the work reveals that, but also it was hugely important to Pannone to be able to cite the works, to cite where each of these three trees went on our oval lawn. It was significant for him to be able to almost act as a visitor to Madison Square Park and to anticipate how people would take in different views of his sculpture. So I think that when you come to the park, you'll see how the sighting of these three trees is really very profound. And in a lot of ways, it's a subtle installation and also incredibly powerful.
And how what will happen at the end of that installation? Will they all go back to Italy?
That's right. They will, yes. Right. They will be shipped back, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds very powerful. I'm excited to see that I have, and I also hope that all the listeners will come because this is airing while it's up.
Right.
And that's very, very, it sounds like a very powerful project because it's
It true. Really is. And also I'll mention that what has been fascinating to watch across the installation is how, of course, the piece was installed in September when it's still a summer landscape in Madison Square Park. And so we saw the trees really surrounded by, you know, extraordinary greenery and a verdant, very verdant setting. More recently, there were changes in the leaf colors, the yellows and golds, have been surrounding the Pannone sculptures, and now it's becoming, the trees themselves, the bronze trees by the artist are very stark. So now the trees in the park, the natural trees, are really mimicking Pannone's installation.
That's wonderful, and I imagine when there's snow, if there is, that'll also change the context of it, which is so unusual for,
right,
you know, a museum, as you're saying, without walls to have, and which is wonderful, and also in a way daunting for the artist. It has to accommodate changes in
right.
In
that's
weather.
True, and we're hoping we get snow here in New York City this winter, so that we can get fantastic photographs of the project in the snow, and you know, so that people can have that opportunity to see how they, as you say, change according to the season.
Well, you could even bring snow into the park. I remember there was that one project. It was years ago. I don't know if you saw that one, but there was perhaps it was some of the first artists in the park, but there was someone whose installation was temporary snow in part of the park, and it was running all summer.
Uh-huh.
So it was really kind of wonderful. So let's go back a little bit to the beginning of your career, before the independent study program and even degrees. What was it that drew you to the arts? Was there something as a child that made you interested in, or was it a first moment where you became interested in the arts or the art world?
I guess that one way I look at this is that my father was a newspaper man, and he, in the days before computers, would go into what was called the composing room, and he would bring us as children into the composing room with him, and there would be people working at tables lining pages with type. So we had, as children, an interest in, you know, visual acuity, and I think that that's how I had an initial passion for the visual world. When I was in college, I interned at different museums, and then in graduate school as well did the same. So I've been very fortunate professionally to be able to realize, you know, some of these early dreams of where I wanted to continue to work and to write and to organize exhibitions.
And by visual acuity with a setting of type, do you mean in terms of design of a paper or the whole process of the California job case and picking all those letters and assembling them?
I think that when you're a little kid and you see these things, it's all absolutely mesmerizing, and it's a visual experience that's really like none other. So I think that that all played a role in my early interest in the visual world.
And how was the, so then you're in undergraduate and graduate school essentially studying art history, and when you were in the Whitney Independent Study Program, I'd like to talk about that a little bit. I know that there's, you know, that works for artists and curators. You were in the curatorial part of that program. How did that add to your sense of the curatorial practice or art history?
I think if you talk to anyone who is a graduate of the Whitney Independent Study Program, that they will tell you that they were truly marked in a very positive way by that year as a Helena Rubinstein Fellow. Probably the most profound experience there is that curators, young museum hopefuls, were working cheek by jowl with studio artists, and their studio space was in the, each artist had a studio space right in the loft where we worked and where we held seminars. So there was a constant interaction and dialogue with these young artists, and we were young curators. So that was, you know, a truly profound experience, I think, for so many of us. Also, the Whitney would bring in different major figures in the field to talk to us about what they did and every day. So that was also an incredible learning experience.
And how was that different from the university experience? I know the Whitney has a particular outlook on the arts, and it's academic in its own right, but it's also New York and ambitious. Did you find that departed greatly from what you were learning in graduate school?
I think that the Whitney program was very interested in hearing directly from artists and how they interpreted their own work, and also how they would interpret certain different readings, different articles that were assigned. So when you're in graduate school, you don't always read primary sources, you read, you know, interpretations of works of art. This was a much more, I would say, completely interactive kind of professional experience, early professional experience.
It was really a conversation, a discussion, you mean, as opposed to what would happen in the class also? I mean, I know there's so many literary references that come up there, and what you're reading and talking about is...
You know, when you're in that program, you use New York City as your classroom. You're constantly going to galleries. There's few other times in your life where you are as immersed in the day-to-day creation and interpretation of works of art as you are in that program, because those are your assignments. And then you can come back to a seminar and have a powerful dialogue about what you saw, what artists were making, how they were making it, what informed the work, theory behind it. I think all of that played together. And for so many young people, it's a first on-site experience about what it is not only to make art, but to interpret art, and also to have those, to have that formative experience right in New York City is exceptional.
It certainly is. And after that program, how did your curatorial career begin?
I began as a young curator at the Brooklyn Museum, where I worked for 13 years in the contemporary art department there, and had extraordinary training not only in contemporary art, but also because Brooklyn is an encyclopedic museum, there are ways of interacting with colleagues in different departments in a truly multidisciplinary way, and working with true experts in different art historical fields. So that opportunity was very profound for me, because I think that you tend to have respect not only for the work that you're displaying, but also for the significance of, the Egyptian art department and the decorative arts colleagues, the prints and drawings department, photography. It's extensive, and these were very senior people in the field. So that was a terrific, wonderful professional experience. And I resigned from the Brooklyn Museum in 2002 and wanted to work independently, which I was able to do as a curator. And I ended up not only continuing writing projects that I had begun while at Brooklyn, but I also organized a couple of big exhibitions for the Jewish Museum in New York. The first was on Louise Nevelson, the sculptor, and that show was on view in 2007. And then I organized an exhibition that opened in 2010 on Houdini. It was called Houdini Art and Magic. And that show was important because it brought together contemporary artists who had been inspired by the magician with historical artifacts from Houdini's era.
That's wonderful. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. I wanted to also ask you, at the Brooklyn Museum, when you left, was that around the time that there was a bit of controversy when Giuliani was mayor?
The Sensation exhibition had already happened by the time I left, yes. So I was able to, I was at the museum during Sensation, and
because that was I mean, I felt bad for the director then and everyone. It's such a wonderful museum. I love that place. And that it became a kind of, it generated a lot of conversation because of that. As much as, I thought that was a shame what happened, it certainly generated a lot of conversation about specific artwork in there and the role of the museum. Was that very difficult to weather as a curator?
I think there was a time in the art world when people started to ask a lot of questions, and probably when we look back on that now, I think that people would acknowledge that a dialogue was not an unhealthy way to go, but I think that the exhibition really stood and probably still stands as an important record of a certain time in contemporary art.
And the Houdini show, I'm sorry to say I didn't see that. How did that bridge the kind of Houdini's life with art? That's a kind of fascinating idea. That was your idea to
That
come up with
was,
that?
I had read a terrific biography by Kenneth Silverman, who was a professor at New York University and ran the Biography Institute there. And he is a Pulitzer Prize winner and a very distinguished scholar, and he wrote a biography on Houdini. I read that a number of years ago and kept thinking about an artist called Matthew Barney, who had used Houdini. Actually, Matthew Barney's a Yalie, so you may have know of him. And he used Houdini really as a muse, and still does, a muse and a source and an inspiration and an influence in his work. And I began to wonder if there were other contemporary artists who also had a profound, Houdini was profoundly important to them. So I began to do research, and it turned out that across media there were living artists working today who found that magic as a subject, as a source, and Houdini in particularly, either literally or symbolically, was an important person to go to for questions about magic and how they could make art inspired by him. So the exhibition not only had examples of contemporary art by Vic Muniz, Jane Hammond, Matthew Barney, Deborah Orapollo, and others, but it also had historic pieces, films, actual magic objects that Houdini had used in his performances, photographs, books, lots of ephemera from the period. And the idea was to talk about how Houdini, even long after his death, he died in 1926, was still an important source for artists working today.
Well, he seems to still be an important source in many ways. I love to go to magic shows, and I've always thought of Houdini as this extraordinary figure. As you talk about the show, the artwork sound, like they must be fascinating. Of course, I know Matthew Barney's work and many of the others, and I'm wondering at the connection, but also the to combine that with objects of Houdini also sounds enormously, exciting on a few different levels. We're going to the show to interpret and understand how artists reference Houdini, but also there's this historical aspect of who Houdini was and what he did. And
So the show was satisfying for me because it, in addition to realizing this exhibition, it also attracted a hugely diverse cross-section of population. There were magic collectors who lent objects to the exhibition and also attended the exhibition. There were young people who were, still fascinated by magic today. There were people interested in contemporary art, who came to see the exhibition, and also many artists came to see the show because Houdini still resonates for them today.
Well, it certainly still resonates for me. I just saw a magic show with my son the other day, and the guy was talking about Houdini, and he was getting out of a straitjacket, and
Right.
he told a little story which I had never heard. But he said, Houdini used to do this behind a wall or a piece of glass, and his brother, apparently, who's also a magician, which I didn't know, said to him, "Houdini, do it in front of everybody. They like that better." And that's what this guy did, and I had never seen anybody get out of a straitjacket before, but it was amazing. It wasn't quite magic, but it was, it was a feat
Maybe it
that
wasn't magic, but it was magical.
yeah, I suppose it was magic. I'm not even sure it was that. It just seemed it was wowing and incredible, and the idea of getting out of locks or getting out of a straitjacket is there was something that perhaps it was analogous for. Being free. The guy that was doing the show was kept saying, there's a million things in this world that fool you. And, as Houdini kind of debunked some, I guess, what do you call it, seances and spirits of the day, that there was this notion of, also you have to watch carefully. It's almost a kind of critical look at who we are and how we ascertain the truth about something.
That's absolutely true. And I also think that, you know, Houdini was an immigrant to America, and like many immigrants of that period, that great symbolism of freedom and freeing yourself from a straitjacket was really analogous to leaving one oppressive culture and entering what was part of the promise of America at the turn of the 20th century. And the straitjacket escapes that you described became his signature outdoor performances. They were especially notable because they were free. People could come and watch a performance on the lunch hour during a work day, and Houdini was very canny, and he would always have those performances right in front of a newspaper building in whatever city he visited. So a photographer would not have to stray too far to get a photo with front page potential for the next day. And somehow that always sold out the house of the evening theater performance. So he was a very smart man.
Smart in terms of there's a tremendous amount of marketing and publicity strategy there.
Absolutely. He was very modern in his practices, and also as an early person who marketed his performances in a savvy way.
It's been wonderful talking to you about these things. The question that I'd like to ask you in closing, and I think it relates to Houdini to some extent, is if you have anything in particular you want to say to artists, because on one hand, you know, artists are interested in, and this reaches artists who are not just students, but artists at all different levels of their career. They're interested in meeting curators and, you know, talking to independent curators. And at the same time, you know, while, you know, you're selective about who you work with, and it's only a few for specific projects, there's also something of the Houdini that could be in every artist in terms of having that kind of tremendous savvy and being canny, as well as, you know, doing things like performances in front of the New York Times building or something like that. But this is kind of an open question, but I'm wondering, in that context, to help understand how artists can or cannot reach curators, or what their relationship should be to them, is there anything you want to say or leave them with?
I think that today we have terrific ability to access different works by different artists through the internet. Artists, you know, regularly send curators their materials online, and that's a terrific way to keep a curator informed of what an artist is doing in the studio, and as well as, of course, you know, people in the field go around and see many, many exhibitions, but I think that and travel to different museums and to art fairs, but I think that there is always the opening gambit, and people used to send slides in the mail, and now they can send emails. So that's we're fortunate to have that interaction with artists.
But is there a way that artists should be looking for certain curators that are appropriate to their work, as opposed to sending emails to many curators? How do they find, do you think, the curator that's right for them?
I think that artists have a real sense of who would be best interested in their work, and that they should truly follow that dream and follow that instinct.
Which is by looking at shows and seeing who, I mean, I know that's how I first found a curator. I saw a show at PS1 that I loved and mm-hmm. saw who the curator was, felt that she would relate to the work and
right.
did in fact. Is that what you mean in terms of?
I think that sounds like a good way to go. Yes, sure.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm grateful for your time.
Thank you very much, Brainerd. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.